You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and/or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for May 30th, 2014. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the Mitch McConnell Obamacare centrifuge, it's The Professional Left with Driftglass and Blue Gal.
Mitch.
Although super colliding superconductor is probably better. It's harder to pronounce.
It's the Higgs boson machine.
Yeah.
Woo!
Because when Obamacare and anti-Obamacare collide, there's this amazing reaction where people don't know what, but I like all the stuff on the menu. I just don't like the paper it's printed on. Then you're a moron.
You're a moron. Order the or food. You're a
yeah. But this really is a test sort of Kentucky is now taking a common core test, I guess, you know,
yeah.
test your collective state IQ. The thing you like is the thing the black guy in the White House got for you.
And Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid got for you.
Got for you. And the thing that's trying to be taken away from you is the thing that your senator is trying to take.
Yep.
They're the same thing.
They're the same thing.
And the fact that he thinks he can say hocus pocus dominocus, they're not,
mm-hmm.
and thinks you're stupid enough to believe that, really tells me a lot about how much esteem Mitch McConnell has for the people who vote for him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And let's see if he's right or not. I don't have a whole lot of faith that Mitch McConnell's going to lose his job. I want him to. And I'd be delighted if that happened.
And for better or worse, his opponent seems to feel that she needs to walk a very narrow tightrope.
Yeah.
About Obamacare. And yes. But to her credit, she's been very specific about the things she would change.
Yes.
Unlike Mitch McConnell, who simply said, repeal Obamacare, but that doesn't mean you're going to lose any of your candy.
Just get rid of it. Just get rid of it. And replace it with what? Oh, this other thing that's McConnell care. Okay. It's the same goddamn thing.
You know, there was another way to go with this, which is Obama could have said, we're going to call it Romney Care, National Romney Care.
Well, let's be clear. Obamacare is not Barack Obama's name.
No.
The Obamacare is the Republican epithet.
That's what we finally just adopted it on our side to say, okay, going to do the time, do the crime.
Exactly. Like teabagging was not our expression. It was yours.
You came up with teabagging. Yes.
You didn't use the Google to look up what it meant.
What it really meant.
We're happy to help you embrace that. And now it's like, quit saying that. Well, okay. No. You decided you would call it Obamacare because it was going to be a failure. There were going to be death panels and Sarah Palin was going to be your vice president. And none of that ever happened. Shall we move on to...
Well, no, I don't want to move on yet. I want to talk about Clive Bundy.
Okay.
Because he's an independent now.
He's an independent.
I changed my voting registration to independent.
I'm independent.
Which means, speaking of Mitt Romney, that the Romney campaign will count him twice.
Yes, which is awesome.
It's great news for John McCain, too.
Because isn't it always?
I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent. I haven't voted for anyone who wasn't a Republican since...
Dewey. And I even voted for that socialist Nixon.
Nixon.
And again,
with his free milk for poor people.
Uh-huh. But I don't blame Clive and Bundy for trying to get out of the hole he has suddenly found himself in.
Mm-hmm.
He thought what he was doing was fine and righteous and everybody had his back. Mm-hmm. And then it all blew up in his face. And rather than what he did was what Republicans do, was just run away. Run away, pretend I was never there. La, 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 la.
Yeah.
And again,
Fox News ran away and pretended he was never on their show. Hannity? Heard of him.
But that strategy... That what I have called in the past strategic forgettery.
Mm-hmm.
It's just never happened. So let's move on. I'll quote Don Draper again. You know, the Republican memory moves in one direction, forward, period. They never look back. Because back there is full of crazy shit that I said last week that I don't want to be held to account to because it turned out it was all a bunch of lies that Sean Hannity fed. Mm. So who can blame Clive Bundy for saying, I'm an independent now, so none of that counts. La, 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 I'm not a Republican. Hey, Sean Hannity's a conservative. He's not a Republican. Ask him. He's not a conservative. He's not a Republican. He's a conservative because he registered with the Conservative Party in New York. Well, you can register whatever you want, man, but you are the biggest Republican testicle cozy in America. And the idea that he can smirk and pretend that he's really not because I have this itty bitty fig leaf, and anybody who says otherwise is somehow exaggerating or lying or arguing in bad faith. The idea that you would ever get into an argument with these douchebags about what they call themselves is stupid. And that's where the press falls apart, because they keep falling for this bullshit that, hey, look, that guy over there changed his hat. He must be a different guy altogether. Mm-hmm. No, he's not. It's the same assholes who were the same assholes they were a month ago and a year ago and 10 years ago and 30 years ago. You just keep pretending they're not. And we on the left keep yelling about it. By the way, hat tip to, what's his name again? Barack
Obama?
Obama, that's his
name. Yeah.
Kenyan usurper.
He came out this week saying both sides don't.
Both sides don't, and the media is the problem.
Yep. But you know who else says the media is the problem? Michael Grimm.
He does. He does, but he doesn't say it in the same way. Barack Obama this last week finally went where liberals have been for a decade.
Decade, exactly.
Which is, no, the problem is A, this fucking false equivalency, and B, that the media keeps collaborating with this big lie.
To say both sides.
Yeah, it's easy for Clive and Bundy or fake journalists like Sean Hannity to say this because that's what gets them what they want, which is, you promise to punish both sides. If I fuck up, great, I'm going to fuck up more. Yeah. Look how badly we broke government. Isn't government awful? And every time they get caught doing it, it's both sides, both sides. Mm-hmm. But that poison has seeped into the well water and is now just everywhere. So the idea that the president of the United States is once again stealing my shtick. Once again, borrowing from my blog or borrowing from our blogs is hilarious and complimentary. And it's also a testament to the fact.
A little frustrating.
And it's a testament to the fact that he never has to run for office again.
Yeah.
Because now he can say stuff like that. Yeah. Like, you know, David Gregg, I keep waiting for him to say, yeah, David Gregg was a douchebag.
Yep.
I don't know why the hell he still has a show. Give that Ronan Farrow a shot.
But, you know, this is why he's not going to say that.
No.
I do want to talk for a minute about Michael Grimm for that same reason, which is this both sides situation then leads people to distrust the media. And then Michael Grimm can come out and say, yeah, see, the media is terrible.
Media is terrible. Can't you see? It's so clear.
Can't you see? They're getting me for being both a bully and a tax cheat. Uh-huh. And it's the media's fault.
Yeah.
For focusing on the negative.
You keep focusing on the can of gasoline and the lighter in my hand rather than the fire, which is what you're supposed to be paying attention to. Yeah, you're right. We're doing that because effects have causes. And I know that violates your contempt for science.
Yeah.
That, you know, things lead to other things, and there's a thing called causality in history and the past and facts and shit.
Mm-hmm.
But for the rest of us, again, for the rest of us standing outside this increasingly weird circle of cultists, it is so strange.
Mm-hmm.
It would be a tragicomedy if this were happening on a faraway little island someplace where we could sort of laugh it off. Or isn't it weird that the natives are behaving this way? Or isn't it strange this alien planet believes the silliest shit? But these people are the ones who are dragging us into the abyss. That's why.
And I did want to point out, too, that in spite of the fact that Michael Grimm is blaming the media and saying that his constituents know he's fighting for them.
Uh-huh.
And so they will not regret backing me up because I will be exonerated. You know who has decided that they're not going to put Grimm on their fundraising dais?
Who?
The National Republican Congressional Committee.
Oh, that's a shame.
Also, his campaign manager quit.
Oh, well,
but his constituents will stand behind him. So that's the good news.
History will vindicate me.
No. Yeah, okay.
History will pave over you if you screw up too badly. And don't worry. The delightful part about being paved over by history on the Republican side is 3-4 years from now, you can come back and they'll, oh, yeah, you were.
He'll be the next Hannity. If Hannity retires, he's got the looks for it. And he's obviously willing to lie nonstop. So he's qualified to be Hannity's substitute.
He's got that belligerent asshole thing down, too.
Exactly.
It's like Alan.
And the kind of Superman haircut, too. So.
It's like Alan West and Sean Hannity had a baby.
It's like Alan West and Sean Hannity had a baby.
Had a baby.
With really blue eyes.
Yes.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yes, all women.
Yes.
This is my turn to get on the soapbox.
This is where I sit very quietly and
hold my...
Listen. And I'm actually... I'm not checking out of this conversation. No. I just think it is wise for me to listen.
We're going to start with Bible Bitch.
Of course.
Bible Bitch.
That's not scriptural. I have been reading Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall, which is about Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell, and it's a very well-written novel. But there's a section in the beginning of the book where the old cardinal is talking about the Bible, and he says...
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the second Henry VIII reference we've made in this podcast?
Probably.
Awesome! We're awesome! All right, never mind.
The old cardinal says about the Bible, you read it, you'll be surprised by what's not in it.
And isn't that the truth? Yeah.
And then he says, show me where it says purgatory, relics, monks, nuns. Show me where it says Pope. You know, and that's just, it's showing so clearly how insulated this cardinal is from any danger at all.
Right. You can say things.
He can say things all he wants because he's safe. So we were talking about Yes All Women, the hashtag, you and I.
Yes, we were.
And you said, yeah, Bridal Bitch should have something to say about this. And I said, you mean the virtuous woman? And you said, who?
That's right.
No, the virtuous woman,
which
is in Proverbs.
I think you're virtuous, but I think it's a little, you know, prideful to be saying, call yourself that. But no, you mean the virtuous woman.
In Proverbs, there is a chapter about outlining the virtuous woman. Who is the virtuous woman? And I'm reading this from The Message, which is a modern translation. And this is just a segment of it.
She is, of course, completely quiet and subservient and...
No.
Oh, no? Really?
No.
Oh, that's weird. What,
no.
What is,
I mean,
what?
She does need a work in sewing and knitting and things like that. But I'm going to read a passage from Proverbs 31.
Okay.
A good woman is hard to find and worth far more than diamonds. Her husband trusts her without reserve and never has reason to regret it. Never spiteful, she treats him generously all her life long. She looks over a field and buys it. Then, with money she's put aside, she plants a garden. First thing in the morning, she dresses for work, rolls up her sleeves, eager to get started. She senses the worth of her work and is in no hurry to call it quits for the day. She's quick to assist anyone in need, reaches out to help the poor. She designs gowns and sells them, brings the sweaters she knits to the dress shops. Her clothes are well-made and elegant, and she always faces tomorrow with a smile. She's a businesswoman.
Yeah, she sure is.
And, you know,
and a good one, too.
She buys land. She sells her handmade goods. And her husband trusts her.
And is proud of her.
As I paraphrase my favorite T-shirt in my closet, my Christian feminist dialectic brings all the boys to the yard.
If they're grown-ups.
Yeah.
If they're big boys, you know.
So getting to this hashtag, and just to give a synoptic background to this, Yes All Women is a hashtag, for those of you who don't follow Twitter or haven't been on the internet this week, the Santa Barbara shooter who shot 6 people last weekend did a manifesto about how women had rejected him and that this was why he was going on this killing spree and that they should have accepted him and that he felt a sense of entitlement to their affections and was denied that and therefore is angry at the world and is going to shoot everybody and so forth. I did not listen to the video or read the manifesto. This is what I've read from media reports because I don't want to give this guy any more attention than I already am.
Well, you know how I feel.
Yeah, I do.
He should be nameless, buried
in an unmarked grave. Absolutely. Uh-huh.
And and his words burned and ashes scattered.
Yep.
The world know of him no more.
Yep. But I've also got to agree with Amanda Marcotte, who said that masculine insecurity and entitlement are a big tangled up mess.
Yeah.
That said, feminine insecurity and entitlement are a big tangled up mess, too. I'm not trying to be both side here.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons that I absolutely love the comedian Amy Schumer and consider her the feminist icon of her day is she skewers feminine insecurity and entitlement. And I'm blonde and I'm single and I can drink and I can have sex and no consequences. Yes. Her character never has any consequences.
What is anything
she does?
What does Paul Giamatti's God say?
Oh, I got to stop making so many white girls.
Yeah.
And Amy Schumer wrote that line for Paul Giamatti. So let's be clear. She's the businesswoman behind this show.
She's the, well, I hate to throw it back 60 years. She's the Lucille Ball.
Yes, she is. Yes,
she knows her business, and she knows what she wants to say, and she knows how to say it, and she's funny.
Well, and this week she did a fabulous segment with Janine Garofalo about celebrity diets.
Yeah.
And she goes to see this celebrity nutritionist about how to get the body she wants. And the nutritionist says, whose celebrity body do you want? And she says, Christian Bale. And Janine Garofalo says, you mean Christian Bale in Batman, or do you mean Christian Bale in, you know, and which Christian Bale do you mean? And it just goes on. And she really, it really is, again, just skewering that sense of, I want my body to be this completely thin, eating is not what I'm going to do.
Right.
Right. But then she likes to eat. So she doesn't want to do any of these. She doesn't want to do the Instagram diet where you just take pictures of your food and then throw it away. But this, yes, all women, to get serious for a moment.
Yeah.
Women sharing their experiences with harassment, with rape, with date rape, and recognizing that women face a very different reality in terms of public interaction because of the threat of rape, harassment, domestic violence, and so forth.
And women live in a different country than men.
They
do.
They do.
It is.
That just is the case.
Uh-huh.
And Glenn Beck is totally wrong, as usual, uh-huh, in saying that this is man bashing. But it's a difficult discussion to have. It's very emotional. And because it's emotional and it's on the internet, I think people tend to cling to absolutes. And so if you want to have a discussion about it, you're either man bashing, as Glenn Beck has said, and that's easy to dismiss.
Uh-huh.
Or if you're just wanting to discuss sexuality and power in a calm way.
Right.
No, you're enabling rape culture.
Right.
Stop it.
Yeah.
It's like, no, I'm not. I'm really not. I'm really talking about a sex positive way to talk about women. Oh,
right.
And in some hate machine circles on the internet, you can't talk about a sex positive feminine experience with heterosexuality.
I have attended those classes.
You have attended, and that's why you're sitting there with my purse. I know.
I have attended those classes. I've been the only guy in those classes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I took, in at least one case, almost on a dare. And let me tell you something about
Let me tell you something about Drift Class. He's white. He's male.
Right.
He's 6'8". And he's heterosexual. Apologetically so.
Yeah. And I don't care who you sleep with. I wish you happiness, whatever that means, if it's as long as it's consensual and everyone involved has agency.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you. I think you should have the same rights as I do, the same privileges as I do. You should have the same opportunities as I do, same education. I think we underinvest in everybody who isn't rich already.
Yeah.
And we pit each other against each other in ways that look eerily familiar to the populist movement, mm-hmm, where you know who has a lot in common with black farmers? White farmers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we can't have those people getting together, so let's make sure they hate each other, mm-hmm, and do our work for us.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, for me personally, I get very defensive when I'm in a certain mood,
mm-hmm,
and in a certain venue, and I get very undefensive and agree 90% in a different venue. Mm-hmm. And I'm the same person. So I kind of understand when I'm feeling like I'm being held up for trial for a crime I personally did not commit,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I get very defensive.
Mm-hmm.
When I can relax, and if it's clear that's not the case, it's simply a matter of, let's talk about the culture in which we are all steeped. We're all soaking in it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's broken.
For women, that is broken. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
It's broken. And it's broken for men, too.
Mm-hmm.
We did a little madman thing today, but that culture is over.
Yeah.
But it continues to echo on. So my general take is there is no American culture. You can say America is a godless country, and for a certain segment of the population, that would be absolutely true. You can say America is a Christian country, and for a certain segment, that would be absolutely true. You can say for some people who were raised by, let's say, a single mom, like I was, more or less, we approach women and the idea of dating and who we want to have a partnership with and who we want to marry very differently than someone who was born at the same time I was, raised in a different family than I was, possibly in the same neighborhood, who comes out of their making the same, hey, isn't it funny? And how I wish my wife was dead. My mother-in-law is a bitch.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Who makes all the same tired, stale, awful, misogynist jokes that were funny in the 60s, but now it's 2014. Yep. And we could live side by side to each other and look a lot alike. And we occupy two completely different mental cultures. Mm-hmm. My impression is, my belief is, his is wrong. Mm-hmm. And it needs to be contained and gotten rid of. But it is a very confusing time. And I think the smart thing for me to do as a man is to be quiet and listen. Mm-hmm. And when I see an opportunity to help, I'm happy to do that.
Well, and this is an opportunity to talk about women and how they feel about their culture. And I think that's wonderful. I, for one, am really glad that women are talking about themselves and their experiences, and then maybe we can work on how to fix this, mm-hmm. because communication is really the start of everything. And I don't think we should use the manifesto of a really sick individual to judge our entire culture.
No.
Because the problem here is this guy had mental illness and access to guns and ammunition.
Yeah.
And that's something everyone can agree. Everyone who's listening to us, I assume, agrees with that. And the fact that he used his perception of sexual rejection to kill other people is really immaterial, because the guy who shot up the Sikh temple in Wisconsin also had some perception.
Right.
That was his excuse to kill.
Right.
You know, what was the perception that led to Sandy Hook? Was it, you know, the kindergarten jihad was out to get me? No, that's a crazy person.
Mm-hmm.
And so deciding that what this guy has to say is somehow something we need to pick apart and use it as a tool to judge our culture, I'm uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that I think it's great that rather than saying all men do this or men are the problem, we talk about ourselves, our feelings of not just victimhood. One of the things that really came across to me in the hashtag was resiliency.
Yeah.
It was, wow, these women are really strong. We are strong. We have survived stuff that a lot of people would turn a lot of people crazy, you know? And we didn't go mentally ill with all of the unwanted touching that happened to our bodies. We didn't go crazy when we were victims of sexual violence.
No.
We didn't go crazy when dad got drunk and hit mom. We grew up and dealt with it and faced the future and tried to do better with our kids. And all of that resilience is something that we have to embrace. And that doesn't mean that we're not going to fight rape culture.
No.
It just means that we have to recognize that resilience is a critical tool in that fight.
And raising children right is tremendously important.
Boys and girls to respect one another and respect themselves. Self-respect and respect for each other, because we have to share this planet.
And understand this is a very delicate balancing act I'm trying to do here. So if my words fail me, please forgive me. It is very important that we teach a junior dude is driving.
Yep. 15, he's got his permit.
Yeah. It's very important that he learn how to operate a car correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Because
for his own safety. Everyone else's.
Here are the rules. Here's how it works, et cetera. I had a friend years and years and years ago up in Chicago who would just dart into traffic as a pedestrian. Mm-hmm. And it was fearless about it. And I'm talking about, you know, heavily traveled roads that he just felt he should be able to cross and they should just fucking stop.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was astonished that, and he said, but I'm right. You know,
and actually he's not right, because pedestrians have the right of way at a crosswalk.
But he just felt I should be able to do this and and it's your job not to hit me with your car.
Yeah.
And you know what? You're right. And I'll put that on your tombstone.
Yes. Right.
It is not validating drunk drivers to say you should really drive defensively because there are really bad drivers out there and they're and just presume that every other driver on the road is
blind and deaf and an asshole and doesn't
presume that out of that alley right now a cyclist who's got his headphones on, and I'll say his because it's mostly guys, and blinders on, is going to come rocketing, blow right through that stop sign.
Mm-hmm.
Just presume that and don't stay at home and hide in terror of the fact that the world is full of people who are assholes or inconsiderate or
have a death
whatever.
Wish. Yes.
Or have a death wish or have or but be aware of the fact that when you're in a particular situation, you are advised to take certain precautions. It is a smart thing to do. It's a wise, nothing to do with you. It's not your fault if it happens. It is simply wise to take a precaution because it's a dangerous world.
Mm-hmm.
And until we make the world a not dangerous place, I don't know when that's going to happen. It is wise to go into the world armed with knowledge
right.
of what you're getting into and what the perils are and where the escape route is.
Mm-hmm.
And
that has to do with college campuses and alcohol, too. That is not excusing rape culture.
No.
It's rape
no.
or any kind of misbehavior on the part of a culture that accepts sexual violence as okay at a party. You know, that's not what we're talking about.
No.
But I looked up some statistics in preparation for this podcast, and I'm not going to use the word astonished because there are people who've called me out on that. But it is estimated by law enforcement that alcohol is involved in half of all murders in this country and a third of all suicides. Alcohol is what breaks down your inhibition to kill yourself.
Yeah, I would imagine part of that is chronic depression caused or exacerbated by self-medication.
Yep, yep.
And the second would be the thing that alcohol does is it drops your impulse control.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You lose your inhibition. And one of those inhibitions might be, you know what? I'm stepping off the ledge.
Yeah.
I've got this
yeah.
thing in my hand that will end my life if I just pull a trigger.
And it's really important to teach young people to watch out for that. If your roommate's drinking a lot, I'm going to tell my daughters, if your roommate's drinking a lot, she might be depressed. She might be self-medicating.
Mm-hmm.
Get somebody to help you, help her. And that's not saying, and if she gets raped, it's her own damn fault. Of course no. it's not. Of course it's not.
And as you enter into policy discussions
mm-hmm.
or cultural discussions,
mm-hmm.
be alert for the fact that that road is full of people who want to deflect you down into their agenda.
Right. Right.
So if you watch Fox News,
mm-hmm.
which for the last week has been the Fox, please, for God's sakes, let's talk about anything other than guns news.
Right.
It's mental illness. It's this. It's that. Let's talk about anything but the fact there's too fucking many guns.
He's a homosexual. Yeah. That's a problem. Yeah,
but,
right.
But even a panel, let's all be reasonable. We can all agree that this guy shouldn't have had guns. But let's talk about mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you notice how you never get back around the discussion of maybe he shouldn't have access to any guns at all.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's lots of people who really don't deserve to have access to weapons at all.
Yeah, but Maya Angelou had a gun.
Yes, I'm sure she did. I'm sure she lived on a farm at some point and had a shotgun. And registered
Statue
or not.
View Online said that, by the way.
But that's that. The object of that comment is to deflect the conversation,
yeah.
is to stop the conversation. Yeah. The object of anyone who disagrees with me is either coerced into doing so or is arguing in bad faith, is a strategy designed to make sure I don't have to deal with my critics.
Yep.
And I don't have to deal with anybody who doesn't
agree
with me.
You call it Glenn Greenwald syndrome, and you're very close to being right about that. Yeah.
I do. It is a very simple strategy that says you don't get into my clubhouse to have this conversation about mm-hmm. race or conversation about culture or conversation about anything without first agreeing that you agree with me on everything all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I don't agree with you. That's why we're having a conversation. That's why it's not a monologue where I'm just nodding.
Yeah.
And so be when you're having these conversations, it doesn't mean people who disagree with you aren't necessarily disagreeing with you in bad faith.
Right.
But people who disagree with you strategically to try to deflect you from having the important conversation, which is how do we get our culture to value and cherish women?
Mm-hmm.
And how do we get our culture to be less violent? And how do we get guns out of the hands of lunatics? Those are the topic sentences.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who wants to say, yeah, but we should talk about all human conditions. And then we'll eventually get around to your subject. Or, I'm sorry, we're only going to talk about drones, period. That's the only thing that matters. People who approach any conversation with those two mindsets are not going to ever agree with you. They're anxious to take your energy and your power and your passion and divert it into their cause or deflect it from changing their status quo.
Mm-hmm.
And just be apprised of it. That's all.
And there are men out there, not killers, not rapists,
mm-hmm.
who in their daily walk around life, feel entitled to women's bodies in
yes.
all kinds of inappropriate ways. And you know what?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the asshole whisperer. No. I'm not here to fix that.
No.
We can raise consciousness about it, and we can shame people who are just assholes, and they can be rejected by women all over. Of course, you know, a lot of assholes find somebody. That's the interesting thing.
Well, there's that. That's probably a different discussion for a different
day. Discussion for a different day.
Yeah.
But I refuse to submerge myself into the culture of their misogyny. I want to talk about the mass shooting thing, too.
Yeah.
We celebrated Towel Day this week, Douglas Adams' birthday. And so I was looking up stuff about Douglas Adams. And in Life, the Universe, and Everything, Chapter 3, he has the theory of the SEP field, which is somebody else's problem.
Yeah.
Somebody else's problem is an actual field in this novel that can be thrown around an object or an issue that people don't want to deal with mm-hmm. or that they can't conceive of as true. He uses the example of aliens at a soccer match. Huh. Just get the somebody else's problem field thrown over them. And the gun problem, domestic and gender violence, climate change, the need for tax and immigration reform. These days, our media covers those with an SEP field in order to protect the wealthy. There's no doubt about it.
We're not going to have those conversations.
We're not going to have this conversation. It's somebody else's problem. And discussing it is somebody else's problem. And so it's really helped me this week to realize that Morning Joe is a huge SEP field generator.
Oh, yeah.
That's their job.
Most of television is.
Yeah. Well, but Micah in the past month has spent 20 minutes talking about single women in Manhattan freezing their eggs. But she spent zero time talking about raising rich people's cap on Social Security taxes.
Oh, yeah.
Because somebody else's problem. And this mass shooting thing, it appears to me, may never reach the threshold of being everybody's problem. It frustrates me no end that we can't get to the point. And I know you got really mad this week and said
I did.
The only time it's going to become our problem is when rich, important people wind up getting shot or their kids wind up getting shot. And then all of a sudden it's a problem for everyone.
Well, I got wound up
because it's my problem.
You can see the cycle. Mm-hmm. You can see the circle going around and around. And there I'm reminded of Robin Williams was on Homicide.
Oh yeah.
And I don't think the performance is online or part of it's online, but he played a father in from out of town, in from Baltimore, with two or three kids staying in a hotel, and his wife is murdered. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. He has no idea. He's completely out of – he has no way to cope with this. Just not the first clue. And the detectives, he walks in on them laughing and joking about stuff, and it makes him furious. Mm-hmm. And he goes and talks to the boss, and the boss says, well, you know, I remember the first homicide case I did in the second, but, you know, after a few hundred, this is how – these guys are really good at their job. This is how they cope with their job. But he's completely destroyed by this. Mm-hmm. And – he's got this wonderful monologue, this wonderful dialogue he's having with, I think, Bayless, one of the detectives, about how once a member of your family is murdered, you join a club. Mm-hmm. And it's a secret club because mm-hmm. nobody wants to be a part of that club. Yeah. But you can tell when you look at each other who the other club members are. And there's this big secret club of people whose lives have been ruined by guns. Yeah. And they have no constituency. They have no NRA behind them. They have no funding from the Koch brothers.
Right.
They are busy grieving, most of them, or getting on with their lives or trying to stitch up their wounds. Yep. And there simply is no massed, focused, hysterical, well-funded lunatic. I'm sorry, lunatic's the wrong word. Fanatic on this side of the issue to match Wayne LaPierre. And it will stay this way.
And Michael Bloomberg's trying, but it's not the same because he's not willing to lie outrageously. To get his point across.
He's not willing to go down into the sewer where the base of the Republican Party lives and tell them that the Kenyan usurper is coming to steal your guns because he wants to socialize your country and turn your kid gay.
Yep.
And he is a secret plan to take disarm this country so he can turn you over and turn you into slaves.
Yep.
There's nobody on the left who is capable of raising an army that's as fanatical and as lunatic and as destructive and as openly hostile and carries fucking guns as the NRA.
Yep.
And until, honest to God, until Joe Scarborough is terrified to go out in public, then this ain't going to change.
Yeah.
Because I don't know about you, but if I'm sitting there trying to have a protest, trying to have a conversation, and 12 guys show up strapped and look and trying to intimidate because they have fucking guns, that changes the way the conversation goes.
Oh, and there was a guy in Texas who everyone thought was going car to car at a stoplight with a cup.
Uh-huh.
It turns out he was going door car to car with a copy of the Constitution, and he had
a gun,
a semi-automatic rifle strapped to the back of his of his jacket, slung over his shoulder. And all of a sudden, all these guns everywhere people, and I know that's in Georgia, not Texas, but this guy was in Texas, open carry, car to car. How does that make you feel, drivers?
Well,
you know,
well, it's, and this is not an expression of your Second Amendment rights.
No.
This isn't even an expression of your First Amendment rights.
Nope.
This is every open carry lunatic who walks through the park with his assault rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Every bunch of armed thugs who walk into an Applebee's are walking, unless you are, I've seen guns in public. We were out to lunch a couple of weeks ago, and there's a cop sitting across from us with her gun.
He was open carry. She was open carry. Yeah.
But every group of thugs who walks into an Applebee's with their AK slung over their shoulder is sending one message, and that's or else.
Yeah.
Don't make me use this.
Yeah.
Because, frankly, these are cowards who can't win an argument without carrying a gun.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand the Constitution. They don't respect the Constitution. The conservative Constitution is yada, 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 guns, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
Not even a well-regulated militia. And there is no amount of talking to these people, reasoning with them, that's going to change their mind. That's what I got really mad about this week. Mm-hmm. I got mad at a rerun of The Daily Show.
Yeah.
Because Jon Stewart was just doing his jaw-dropping, fist-shaking indignation, blah, 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 about something or other. I forget what it was. And I just sort of had it. I said, you know, every one of these issues now comes with the caveat that we are talking to no one but ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
That there is absolutely nothing that a reasonable person can do to budge a Republican to force the people who are causing all of this strife and trouble and destruction and hate and rage to change. And there's nothing we can do to get the vast number, 50% of Americans who don't give a shit, who don't pay any attention to any of this at all, to pay attention to it. Mm-hmm. We are talking to ourselves. And so we can get, isn't it terrible to shutting down abortion clinics? Yeah, it is. Isn't it terrible that gun nuts are being turned loose in this country? Yeah, it is. Isn't it awful that that children in schools are being taught science is a joke and climate change is a fraud perpetuated
by... Well, at the same time being taught what happens when a gunman comes into their school.
Yeah.
What a lockdown feels like.
Yeah. Isn't that awful? And is there anything that we're going to do to break through and change the dynamic of the situation anytime in the near future? And the answer is no.
No. Yep.
We're not. And
now, that said, I tempered your rage at that point.
You did.
A little bit by saying, you know, the zeitgeist is changing in terms of what is cool or not.
That's true.
And Jon Stewart is chipping away at that. And I even saw that in 2008. Going to a restaurant and hearing someone say, well, yeah, I'm going to vote for John McCain, you know, and all of his friends at this, and they were young professionals, all of his friends and the waitress said, oh, come on, of course you're not going to do that. You're not going to vote for that old white guy. Come on. You know, that's just that's not cool. Not that they didn't get into a policy debate with him. They wouldn't have been able to get into a policy debate with him. Some of the people at that table, I'm sure. But the perception of what is the cool thing to do? I mean, that's why gay marriage has changed so radically.
Mm-hmm.
Is that people have gotten to know enough gay people to realize this isn't cool. It's not cool to be a homophobe. And that doesn't mean that they understand gay culture or even appreciate it. But it's not cool to be a homophobe.
And
let them do what they want.
You can't demonstrate the downside.
Right.
I'm sorry. Why is this hurting me in any way? Why does this affect me at all?
Yep.
And when you got to go to the drawer and pull the Bible out, it's like, no. Show me in my pocketbook and in my day-to-day life how the hell.
And in my backyard.
Yeah.
What
Bob
difference
and Steve,
does it make?
Yep. Who I know.
Yep.
Or Leslie and Joan, who I know. Letting them get married affects me in any way other than, you know, we'll have to go to another wedding.
Yep.
Who cares? And once that point
or
is
not
reached,
you don't have to go to the wedding if you don't want to,
but I don't care because I don't do weddings. I hate weddings. Everybody cries. But and you can reach that with same-sex marriage. You can't reach that point with gun control.
Mm-hmm.
Because the people who are opposed to it don't pull out a Bible, they pull out a gun.
Yep.
and they don't. And it's not that they can scrape together a few bucks for their cause. They get millions and millions of dollars, and they're able to effectively wield political power in a country where the minority party can effectively stop everything, which suits them just fine.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I want to talk about the Neighborhood Recovery Initiative, but let's do that next.
Okay. Well, you've been wanting to do that for a lot of weeks. Where are we on time? Oh, we better stop.
We're over. Let me tease it.
Tease it.
Yeah. Here's what we're going to talk about next week. Coming next week, we're going to talk probably next week a little bit about the VA scandal.
Yeah.
And not because a lot of things are going to happen next week, I'm pretty sure. It's now a bipartisan mess where everybody wants something to be done. So when that happens, things happen. But I overheard my senator, Dick Durbin, say something that eerily sounded like Driftglass on the radio this morning, because he actually lives down here and he goes on the radio every now and then, talking about how, the VA is broken and it's awful and it sucks, but we dumped 2 million new veterans into it.
Yep.
And a bunch of Vietnam veterans who weren't getting treated, and a bunch of veterans who had depression. So we loaded up this system that was already bursting at the seams with a whole bunch of new people and never funded it correctly. And then we overlaid it with this bureaucratic mandate that you're just going to make it work. And if you've ever been inside of a project where you it's clear you don't have anything like the resources you need to do anything remotely approaching your objective, and the person at the top says you get no more anything, but you have to fulfill these impossible deadlines, you are dooming that to failure. And the only question is exactly how does that failure manifest itself this time, because it will always fail. So we'll tease that. And the second tease is, why have the Democrats in Illinois passed an unbalanced budget? On purpose.
On purpose.
They did it on purpose.
On purpose.
I'll let you all guess why. They passed, I think, $37 billion in spending and $35 billion or so in revenue. Why did they do that?
They
did it for a reason. And the third is, go to my blog or go online and look up the Neighborhood Recovery Initiative.
Boy.
Speaking of projects that were wired to fail, this is something I wrote about my blog a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now going to become a big thing.
It's going to become a big thing in the gubernatorial race in Illinois.
It will.
And you're going to be the Steve Kornacki of the Illinois gubernatorial race.
I sure am. Reporting from the state capitol in Illinois. Yeah, it's going to be a big deal, and I'll tell you all why.
We're going to piece this together. We're going to have 55 minutes about the Neighborhood Recovery Initiative.
I know everyone thinks this is a slow news period. There's more than enough things to talk about if you want to talk about things that
matter.
You and I consider important.
that actually matter. And actually, it just as a footnote to your VA. Footnote to your VA footnote. Bernie Sanders also said today, we don't have a VA problem. We have a war problem.
Yes.
And
exactly.
Let's face it, when you have a Defense Department that cannot be audited because it's too big and has too many computer systems that have all been contracted out that don't talk to each other, and you have a Republican Party, yes, I'm talking about you, Paul Ryan, who leaves the Defense Department off of every budget consideration, but the VA can be cut. And privatize. I can't wait. I'm with Chris Hayes on this. I can't wait till the Republicans say the solution to the VA problem is to privatize it.
Yeah, because you want to know what happens then?
You want to watch people get really mad? You want to watch people who are potential teabaggers?
You want to watch people with guns suddenly on your side of the issue?
Talk about privatizing the VA.
Everyone look up the bonus army.
Yeah.
All right.
Exactly. We angry vets. Let's make them angrier. Okay. Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Each week, we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Cone. It's K-H-O-N. Now, the owner didn't say anything about him, but one look at Cone. And I was thinking Klingon, obviously.
Yeah.
So take a look at Cone.
Yeah.
And you'll see Klingon in there. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. By the way, this is a good time to send in an internet kitty because there's not a long wait list for, we don't call it a wait list, Driftglass.
No.
You will be informed by email when it is your kitty's time to ascend to the throne of internet kittydom. There is no waiting. There's just an ascension to the throne. So your time will come. Feel free to write us about anything. We love hearing from you.
Mm-hmm.
Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Unions letter on the air unless you say otherwise. So, Driftglass, how are the Internet Kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Galley, Internet Kitties say rest in peace, Maya Angelou. because she taught us all why the cage bird sings, and the internet kitties had nothing to do with it.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey dovin'. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
The Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2014, Driftglass Blue Gal Podcast.
And now it's time for You're Watching It Wrong with Driftglass.
In stereo. Because on Mad Men, it's 1969, and stereophonic, even quadraphonic music is on the horizon.
This week, instead of Science Fiction University, we're doing You're Watching It Wrong with Driftglass. And you put the comma wherever you want.
Yeah.
Well, and I think doing our television discussion after the music helps, because people who don't want spoilers for various shows can just turn it off, and that's
skip right on over
it. Want you to do.
Although there is some science fiction in it this time.
Well, yeah.
A little bit of science fiction in You're Watching It Wrong.
Geekiness from the writers of this show.
Well, and from one at least one viewer, that's me.
Yeah, and you did some digging that you found stuff that no one else, I think, wrote about this week.
No one else, because no one else is as obscure and as weird as I am. Did I ever tell you about the time in some lit class I held forth on Ernest Hemingway's, the real meaning of an Ernest Hemingway story?
And did Ernest Hemingway then walk in and tell you that you were completely wrong?
You know nothing of my work. Just about. Someone pointed out that the events I was referring to all occurred well before or well after the story was written. Therefore, it could not possibly have been related. But I did make a convincing case for it.
I was going to say, it's a great point if it were true.
If it were true.
Back on Fox News.
I knew I would have no future as a teacher of literature, but a great future as a professional liar, which there is another word for writer. So,
right. Or Fox News host.
Yeah.
One of the two. Hannity's a professional liar, you know.
Yes, but he's not really good at it.
No, he's
he's not really very good. He only lies to the receptive, sort of gaping, open-mouthed baby bird audience. That's the only place that his con job works, in front of dupes. If you want to, you got to, and this is one of the things about Mad Men this week, he said, cleverly lighting into it. The true great con. Mm-hmm. As Ricky Jay will tell you, can you baffle other magicians?
Yes.
Can you con a con man?
Mm-hmm.
Can you pitch something that makes
a bunch of pitch men who it work?
And who know every one of your tricks.
Yep.
And have all of them go, yeah, damn, man. That's really good.
I'm sold. How do you do that?
Yeah. And we saw that. And this is, as you might guess, we're sneaking up on a review of this mid-season semi-finale.
Yep.
Of Mad Men, which everyone has already talked about. So this is well-plowed ground, except they haven't talked about it the way we're going to talk about it.
The way you're going to talk about it.
Sure. Well, it is 1969. And
we are also catching up and binge-watching season. We're into season two now. Yes. We've been kind of catching up. So I had to remember when we watched this Sunday night. Oh, wait. No, this is 69, not 61. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, and one thing that first of all, let me recommend to anybody who's listening to this, who is a writer or wants to be a writer or understand how writers work, there is a wonderful Paris Review interview with Matthew Weiner.
A listener sent to you, correct?
Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah. And it's,
thank you very much.
It's terrific. It's very good. It is extremely dorky for me. It was just pure heroin for me, because it was writers talking about the writing process and how they got to be a writer and the way you sort of collect junk in your head, phrases and so forth. There's one, let me just share this one little thing about when he was working on The Sopranos, the Matthew Weiner, or Weiner, depending on which side of the Hudson River you're on, I suppose. He was sitting down with another writer, I think, and the writer's assistant, talking to some medical experts about how some procedure happens, how this sort of thing happens.
And it's sort of background information for writing a police procedural or a medical procedural, right?
Well, mafia procedural.
Mafia procedural.
Sort of, this is how...
You got to know how a hospital works, sure.
Yeah, this is how the medical situation would be handled. And the writer's assistant dutifully took down all the medical information. And Matt and his writing partner or friend only took down two pieces of information, and it was the same two, and it had nothing to do with the medical jargon. And the first one was like, everyone with insurance is a VIP.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just good information to know.
Yep.
The second was a piece of professional jargon performing a wallet biopsy. So I just cracked up when I heard it. I said, of course you want to grab those out of the whole stream of consciousness about how the medical thing works.
Mm-hmm.
They pulled the same two things because those are the cool things. Those are the you used a phrase wallet biopsy. You know everything you want to know.
Yep.
It reveals the whole scene.
The whole scene is we're going to sell to these people mm-hmm. optional things that bring a higher profit margin to our hospital. Yes.
We're going to figure out what your price range is.
Yep.
And then we're going to go there.
You know that mole there? We could take care of that for you.
I can come right off. Or as Monty Python sketch, you know, there's nothing wrong with you that an expensive operation can't prolong. So, but that sort of thing is in the interview, and it shows up on the screen. It really does show up on the screen, and he makes the point that had he not done The Sopranos, then Mad Men would just be a soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
That he was working with writers, with David Chase and writers there, who told him when something is tickling your subconscious, go there.
Yep.
And that's not just a detail for the background. What you're probably detecting is the real story. Mm. Follow it. Just keep following it. Go, 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 go. And you're going to make a lot of mistakes, but you're going to find out what the real story is about.
And so here is Don Draper selling the advertising business to the one person in the entire show who is probably most his peer in talent and in disposition.
Yep, and is most desperate
yep.
to get out of advertising.
Yeah.
Don Draper is trying to sell a drowning man on the idea that he should jump back in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
In front of a bunch of people, many of whom hate him and know every one of his tricks and don't want him to succeed. This is not a neutral room at all. He's selling this partnership to save his own job, to save the company more or less, and to get rid of the guy who really has it out for him.
Mm-hmm.
All in one fell swoop. But it won't work unless this one guy who has tried to kill himself practically, who has tried to commit professional suicide right at the beginning of the show, and who really wants the hell out, doesn't want to do this anymore, please, I'm done, I'm so over this. He has to convince him to sign a 5-year contract. Maybe 8 years, but a 5-year contract.
5 years.
To do this awful, shitty job that he never wants to do again. And Don Draper ignores everyone else in the room and talks to him like a writer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He talks to him, I know you. You're like me. Because he does the thing nobody expects him to do. He lays all of his own failures out on the table,
mm-hmm.
which is completely unexpected. You know, this confident guy,
yep.
the last time he laid his failures out on the table, he blew the Hershey account.
Yep.
And he lost it, and he lost his job practically, and he ruined his career. And he said, look, I've hit rock bottom. You don't want to go there.
Right.
You really don't want to end up where I'm at.
I've written tags.
Yes.
To get back into it because I need this work. And so do you. You and I are the same.
Exactly. I need to do the work. He doesn't need the money necessarily. He needs to do the work. He's one of those poor, pathetic souls that we both know and both are, frankly.
Yes.
Who need to write, who need to yep. do this thing. And he appeals to him at that level. He says, well, I'll take all the corporate crap off your back. You won't have to worry about partners meetings or anything like that. All you have to do is the work. And that's what sells him. He finds what the guy really is, really, really, truly. He's a writer, like me. He talks to him as a peer. And it works.
Mm-hmm.
And it works mm-hmm. reluctantly, but it works. And to everyone's astonishment, the tables are completely turned around. And what you realize if you watch a really good drama of any kind, but especially this show,
mm-hmm.
Is that everything in the frame is there for a reason. Every word being spoken by every character has been thought about very, very carefully.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, it's the summer of 1969. A guy named Jim Cutler is out to destroy Don Draper.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Cutler doesn't believe in technology, doesn't believe in people at all.
Mm-hmm.
He believes in deploying overwhelming technology to get the job done. And he really hates Don Draper because Don is a writer. He really hates everything about him. And he's cool, and he is robotic, and he is methodical, and he's heartless. And there's this moment at the very beginning of the show where Ted offers to help a couple of his clients who were in this little tiny plane with him off to the next life.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, over there we go. He cuts the engine off on his plane. We've just opened up on the Apollo moon landing. Three guys crammed into a small tin can. And then we cut to three different guys crammed into a small tin can. And I thought the Major Tom theme was kind of cool because mm-hmm. Major Tom, the David Bowie song, also released in the summer of 1969. Space Oddity, also released in summer of 1969, was about a guy who is up in space and decides, you know what? Maybe I don't want to come back from this.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
mm-hmm.
I want to end this. Maybe I want to go away. So you have this guy in a pilot seat who's saying, you know what would be kind of cool? If we all crashed and died, which didn't mm-hmm. sell well with the clients.
No.
But Ted is willing to just sort of give him a warning and let him off the hook for doing that, which is weird. Jim is willing to let him off the hook.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, yeah, just for, oh, whatever.
Yeah, you know, they were mad. You're going to hear from Pete,
whatever.
But,
yeah.
You know.
Whatever, okay.
And then, mind you, this is a sin far greater in its implications than threatening to kill clients. It's far greater.
It's kind of illegal.
It's way worse than what Don did.
Yeah.
And yet, such is Jim's hatred of Don that he doesn't really care that it's uneven. He wants to kill Don and keep Ted on as sort of a little sock puppet.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the problem. Well, here's what you notice. This is all taking place in the summer of 69. We know who Jim's character is. And when Ted is explaining to Jim why he did what he did, he said, well, you were a pilot. And Jim says, yeah, but when I was over Dresden, I wanted to live. I didn't want to die. And
I didn't turn off my airplane in mid-flight. Right.
Well, but yeah. Here's the thing. He could have been a bomber pilot, any kind of pilot in World War II.
Yeah.
Anything. Could have been a fighter pilot.
Why Dresden?
Why Dresden? Dresden was the worst, probably the worst outside of Tokyo and in European theater, definitely. The most useless and vicious destruction of human life.
I'm going to say it. The most war crimey thing
absolutely was. That's exactly what it was.
Yeah.
We killed somewhere between 20 and 25 or 30,000 civilians.
For nothing.
In a completely unstrategic city that was known for basically its miniatures mm-hmm. and its pastries. It had no strategic value at all. And we bombed the shit out of this city from high altitude bombing with incendiary devices. And we created a firestorm. And I know that that's a term that people use metaphorically, but a literal firestorm where the atmosphere catches fire and you burn everything under you.
Mm-hmm.
So we incinerated the city center of Dresden. Jim Cutler incinerated, calmly and coolly, I'm sure, incinerated the city center of Dresden. What some people forget is that under the city center, in a disused slaughterhouse, American POWs were being kept. One of those American POWs was Kurt Vonnegut.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt Vonnegut survives, becomes a writer, and ends up in the spring of 1969 publishing his take on the slaughter of people, of innocent people, in his most famous novel, Slaughterhouse Five, where he really indicts basically people like Jim Cutler.
Mm-hmm. And it's published the exact same year.
Same year, a couple of months apart.
Cutler is speaking. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah.
It could have been any city. And what is Jim Cutler trying to do now? Jim Cutler is trying to bomb another writer out of existence.
Yep.
And he's going to fail at that, too.
Yeah.
So that's where my brain goes. That might have been completely fortuitous. It could have been completely
accidental. I don't know. Yeah.
I don't know. But it's certainly, I know that writers put things in the frame for a reason. I know they put mm-hmm. telescopes in a bunch of scenes for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
I know that
mm-hmm.
they put words in the actor's mouth for a reason. And there's a reason why Jim Cutler was a Dresden bomber pilot
mm-hmm.
rather than a Berlin bomber pilot.
Well, and as you've been talking, I've been thinking about my reaction to this episode and where my brain goes.
Mm-hmm.
And when you mentioned that, you know, every writer, for the writers of this show, every word on the page has meaning.
Yes.
I love the fact that when it comes to Don's marriage, no words on the page
right.
is what is used to describe what's going on.
Very well put. Yeah. Silence.
He says to her, do you want me to come out on the phone? And she's sitting on her with a telescope, by the way.
Yep.
Sitting on in her singles pad, you know, reading a magazine with the phone out by the veranda. I mean, outside, you know, she's just outside. And the contrast between Don sitting at his sofa in his dark office
mm-hmm.
and his wife in the bright California sunshine outdoors, just reading, you know,
yep.
for leisure, is very stark contrast. But he says, do you want me to come out? And she, there's just silence.
Yep.
And he knows his marriage is completely over.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll always take care of you. I'll always, no, I'm fine. You know, I don't really need your money even. I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a parallel with that then that is just lovely when he's flying on the plane with Pete.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. Pete says, well, aren't you going to see your wife? And Don says nothing.
Nothing.
Nothing. Mm-hmm. And Pete knows immediately. Oh, well.
Yep.
You know, well, wives, what are you going to do? Marriage is a racket.
Yeah.
Is that what he says?
He
marriage
did.
Is a racket.
Which is a nice throwback to Smedley Butler.
Yeah, yeah.
War is a racket.
Sometimes there's words on the page, and sometimes there don't need to be words on the page, and it means just as much. But it's very conscious what they do.
It is.
Clearly, Don's marriage at this point is an empty page. There's
it
just
is.
Nothing there. So.
And it's a great, so I think this particular episode was very well set up to do what it needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote in my blog, the great accounting department in the sky, in the Mad Men sky, balanced the accounts this week.
Yep.
Almost everybody gained and lost something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Almost everybody gained more than they lost,
yeah.
Depending on how you look.
Especially
at
Peggy. I think Peggy really gained a lot. That hug from Don was a professional pat on the back.
Yeah.
And she wanted that so badly.
And she got it.
And she got it.
And he was really, I know enough alcoholics to know the reformed alcoholic looks an awful lot like a one who is pretending to be reformed.
Yes.
Who knows all the right things to say, all the right things to do right before they mm-hmm. sort of crash and burn again.
Yeah.
But it seems very clear he, as a working writer who just wants to build this thing, to make this thing work, is perfectly willing to do anything,
mm-hmm.
including step back and be, you know, the guy in the background, the
number two,
the MC.
Yeah.
This is, you know, and you know, he knows his protege has done really well.
Mm-hmm.
And she, looking around, the only thing that matters among writers is the approval of your peers.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the only peers in this group are Ted, Peggy, and Don.
And that's going to be the triangle for the final seven episodes, in my opinion. I mean, as I predicted, is since Ted is back and Don is there and Peggy is there, that that dynamic has to work itself out.
Well, I stretched very far by pointing out that the use of a telescope was in this episode was by one of the nerdy people that we've never met before.
Mm-hmm.
He was interested in the space, in the moon landing. This is all about the moon landing,
mm-hmm.
but not really.
Yeah.
Because you can see other things with a telescope. And he takes Sally out in the yard, who's growing up, and shows her Polaris.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he shows her a star that's very, very far away. And I just sat and thought about that. I said, you know what? You're not really looking at Polaris. You're looking at Polaris as it existed over 400 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You have the advantage.
That light just got here.
That light just got here. So back when I did a little research, back when that light left Polaris and arrived on Earth in 1969, that light left the star right about the time was the Pope was deposing and excommunicating Henry VIII.
Ah.
Now, I don't think writers really got that fussy about it, but it made me think it because I'm a weirdo and I look for things like this to see, even if they're not there. The fact that although all the accounts are balanced, Peggy gets real power, but she loses her surrogate son,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and Roger loses a surrogate father,
mm-hmm.
but gains a kingdom,
mm-hmm.
a small kingdom within a larger empire, but a kingdom nonetheless. Jim loses his job, but makes a fortune.
Mm-hmm.
Ted loses his mind, but gets some of it back, thanks to Don. Bert loses his life,
mm-hmm.
but gets to stay around just long enough. He's a child of the 19th century. Gets to stick around long enough to see a man land on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And on and on. Joan loses her gut fight with Don,
mm-hmm.
but makes $1 million.
Yep.
$1,000,000 in 1969.
Very satisfied with that. Yeah. She well should be.
So everybody gained something and lost. And Roger or Don lost his marriage. But he gained a real peer. And he gets to go back and take another shot at doing the job he wants to do in the first place. But what interests me is the fact that we are viewing this whole show from essentially 45 light years distance. We're in the future.
Mm-hmm.
We know what's coming.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so... the tension that's going to drive
tin soldiers and Nixon's bombing.
Exactly.
We're finally on our way.
Exactly.
Yes. Ohio hasn't happened yet.
No.
Yeah.
Kent State's just a college.
Yeah.
Stonewall hasn't happened yet. Woodstock hasn't happened yet. Nobody knows who the hell Charles Manson is.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has, Fred Hampton and Mark Clark are still alive. And nobody has, as I wrote in my blog, the 60s have yet to crawl off and die under a porch at the Altamont Speedway.
Yeah.
So the overhang, the tension that remains, the book that needs to remain to be balanced is these people's world is still radically unbalanced.
Mm-hmm.
They have rebalanced it within their little terrarium, but their entire world is about to be completely rebooted and reformatted in ways that they're not going to be very happy with. Might cost some of them in their lives, but that's what drives the rest of the show. So we have very effectively resolved some of the tension. This is what Mark Twain talked about. In the first chapter, you basically promise something.
Mm-hmm.
The second chapter, you should do this every paragraph, but the second chapter, you deliver on that promise and make another promise. So the whole idea is that you draw the person through the narrative by promising them you're going to show them something cool, and then you show it to them, sort of, but in that showing, you leave another door open. And you keep moving them through the plot. We have resolved some of the tension in the show. We've balanced some of the books. We've set up the biggest tension of all, which is the second half of 1969.
Right.
And so
that's coming.
And on that note,
get ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening, guys. We hope you have a great week.
Oh, I'd like to do one shout out to Harlan Ellison superfan.
Yeah.
Named Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
There was this quote from an Ellison column, a Harlan Ellison column, who just turned 80, by the way.
Happy birthday, Harlan Ellison.
Glad you're still kicking.
Yeah.
Who wrote...
Thanks to your wife.
Yeah, frankly. Thanks to your wife and your friends. But Harlan Ellison wrote some television commentary in the 60s and 70s called The Glass Teat, which was collected in a book, and I have copies of it somewhere in a box, somewhere in the basement. But he wrote about this. He wrote about the Apollo 11 moon landing and how disappointing it was for some people. Not hugely, but it was kind of like, well, I've been there already.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there with Ray Bradbury and Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov. I've already gone. But I understand why you guys are thrilled by it. But this sort of, there was this great moment where the world was united, as he puts in his column. Right up the, there was this moment where all the crooks and heist men and cat burglars were sitting in front of their TV sets and the world's crime rate dropped to nothing.
Yep.
And then Nixon opened his mouth. And everybody
and
went back
it.
To bugging each other and fighting each other and bombing each other.
Yeah.
But there was this noble moment, and very much paralleled in the show, this noble moment that becomes a Burger Chef commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And we're back to the sort of grubby world. So here we're going to have to park ourselves at Tranquility Base until 2015. That's where we're at. We're sitting on the moon. We're literally, our characters, the astronauts are sitting on the moon. You haven't made the return trip yet, which I thought was a lovely touch.
Yeah.
And but I couldn't find the full quote because I couldn't find my copy of the book. And Harlan Ellison superfan, Jimmy, when I sent up a flare, got it for me.
Yep.
So thank you, Jimmy.
Thank you, Jimmy.
Remember, you're watching it wrong, but now you know how to watch it right when you watch it on the deep dark.
You're watching it wrong with Drift Glass.
With Drift Glass and Blue Guy.
That's the point. No, you're watching it wrong. We're going to make this your segment.
Really?
We're watching it. Oh. You're watching it wrong with Drift Glass, and then they can put the comma wherever.
So you're my Don Draper then.
I am your Don. I put a branding on this for you.
You got the all everything prepared. Then you said, and now to talk us through it.
It's Drift Glass.
It's Peggy. So thank.
And people can put a comma wherever they want.
If
you watch it wrong with Drift Glass, or watch it. Wrong with Drift Glass. There you go. Okay. Good podcast. Except that fascist misogynist Drift Glass kept talking over Blue Gal.
Shut up, Blue Gal. I got more stuff to say about women.
Hey, Blue Gal, let me tell you what I know about feminists. You're the Clive Bundy of feminism, aren't you?
I am. As long as it's just me talking, why don't you go make me a sandwich? That's okay.
I love you.
I love you too, baby.
I haven't come a long way, but I am your baby.
You are already there.
Bye.
Bye.